Well, I said we would just finish up our discussion of countertransference, and I wanted to be sure to point out to you that there are things that happen in psychotherapy that are very inappropriate, and they're because of the therapist and the therapist's own feelings. But since therapists have feelings and therapists have conflicts, it becomes an issue that has to be dealt with. Now, in Freud's time, and actually right up into the current times, one of the feelings is that if a person is going to do intensive psychotherapy, really if a person is going to do any kind of therapy, they really ought to have been in therapy themselves at some point. They ought to have, you know, very carefully examined their own conflicts, their own difficulties, and be aware of what are issues that might come up that they are uncomfortable with, so that they do not allow treatment to suffer from something that's going on in their life. But even with that, I mean, countertransference comes up in ways that are just human. I remember one time I was doing group therapy with a woman, a very, very talented person, and a patient brought up a very painful divorce that he had been through. And this patient started talking about the divorce, and she changed the subject. Very unlike her. I mean, very surprising to me that it was a pretty insensitive thing to do. So we discussed something else for a while in the group, and another group member goes back to the person who clearly wanted to talk about this difficult divorce and brings it up again, and she changes the subject again. And eventually, we don't discuss this in the session. That is, we discuss all the things that, all other kinds of things. So after the session, I said to her, I said, you know, I'm really very surprised that you changed the topic when so-and-so was talking. And she says, did I do that? And I said, yeah. I said, you know, this guy is obviously having all kinds of intense feelings about this divorce that he's going through, and you didn't want to allow that to be discussed. And at that time, and I did not know this about her, at that time, she then told me, well, she herself is going through a very painful divorce. And she hasn't come to grips with it yet. And so, since she had not come to grips with her own divorce, she certainly wasn't ready to let somebody else talk about this. And yet it was very unconscious. I mean, she was very surprised when I told her that she had done this. And she was very open. I mean, once I told her, immediately she recognized what this was all about, was able to talk about it herself. But there is that kind of countertransference. Now, the really bad countertransference that takes place is when the therapist takes advantage of the patient for the therapist's gratification. And you've certainly heard about times when therapists have been sexual with their patients. Now, in all forms of psychotherapy, it is unethical to be sexual with your patient. Not only is it unethical to be sexual with your patient, like in the session, it's unethical to be involved with your patient outside the session. And most ethical codes, you really can't see your patient outside the session for at least a couple of years after therapy ends. And most would hold you really should never get involved in a relationship with someone that you've treated. But that kind of behavior does go on, and I want you to be aware that it has been recognized and that this term countertransference really does cover all of that. But in the extreme, you really have a fairly regressed therapist who is actually working out their own conflicts, where obviously the therapist is dominant. And you can imagine that the gratifications, primitive kind of gratifications therapists get. Yes?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I know, but is it common for therapists to go under a psychoanalysis before actually beginning to practice, or is it just like
In a lot of training programs, people are really encouraged to undergo some kind of psychotherapy. Might be psychoanalysis, might be another kind of therapy, but to undergo therapy before you actually begin practicing. The program that I was most involved with, almost all of our students were in therapy while they were in graduate school. It was very common. And we encourage that. And they would be in therapy with somebody who, you know, who was not on the faculty, for example. I mean, somebody who had no other role in their life except to be the therapist. And by the way, that's easier to do in big cities. You know, I spent so much of my career at Northwestern University Medical School in Chicago. Well, in Chicago, you know, you can have a therapist and you'll never see that person any other time. But if you're going to a graduate school in a small town, there are less therapists and there's more interaction with people, and it's more difficult to you know, in the community, to be sure you can find people who don't have any other interaction with the student except to be their therapist. Now, a couple of other concepts I want to mention. You may have heard of the concept called secondary gain. And we often think of secondary gain in relationship to neurosis. Now, what secondary gain means is that you benefit from your symptoms. Let's say somebody comes in and they've been referred because they're having headaches. And they really are having headaches. And you're able to cure them one way or another, either with therapy or some behavioral intervention. There are lots of behavioral interventions, actually, that are very good with headaches. And so the person doesn't have headaches anymore. That is, whatever was the original cause of them, it's gone. But the person finds that he or she develops headaches at certain times. And they come in the second time saying, you know, the headaches are back, but when you really begin to listen, you realize that they don't seem to be very motivated to work on this headache problem again. Like maybe they had biofeedback the first time, they're not really interested in doing that. And you recognize that they must be getting something from this. And often, what people found when they had the symptom, like they had headaches, they got a lot of attention. Now that they don't have headaches, they don't get as much attention. They also had control, and control to so many people is important. So that by getting a headache may mean I don't have to go out to someplace I don't want to go. Not only that, but the person whom I'm involved with becomes very solicitous, takes care of me. In other words, I'm getting a lot of gratification from having a headache. Or if I don't want to be intimate and I say I have a headache, then the person says, well, that's okay, I understand. But you get lots of control, you get lots of benefits. Secondary gain refers to the benefits that you get from having a symptom. And if the person gets a lot of secondary gain, the person is hesitant to give up the symptom. So, and that's an important concept to be aware of. Now, during the early 20th century, when we were looking at certain kinds of disorders, one disorder was called hysteria. And one form of hysteria took place when you developed some kind of paralysis. And the people developed paralysis of their hand, paralysis of their leg. Some people became hysterically blind. I mean, they really couldn't see. And but the symptom really served a purpose. You know, for example, I remember a person who had a leg paralysis. The person all of a sudden couldn't walk. And, so they were referred to a neurologist who said, there's really no reason you shouldn't be able to walk. And they were referred to an orthopedic specialist who says, you know, I mean, there's absolutely no reason you shouldn't be able to walk. The person can't walk. Well, get referred for therapy. And you don't get very far. You really can't figure out what's going on. Then you talk to the spouse. And you find out that actually this spouse and this person who's suffering this paralysis have had a very conflicted relationship for the last 8-10 months. And the spouse has decided to leave. And just as she was about to leave, this guy becomes paralyzed. Now she feels too guilty. And so she's not going to leave, because at least not going to leave while he can't walk. So what happens here is you have a symptom, and it looks like, what a terrible thing to happen. I mean, this poor guy can't walk. Actually, he's feeling very positive about having this symptom. Even though he comes in, woe is me, you know, I can't walk, etc. But actually, the symptom is serving a very unconscious need in him. He just is devastated by the possibility of losing this person. And this gives him a certain control in his life. Now, if you work with the couple, and if they were able to resolve some of the conflict that they have, or they're able to resolve that they should separate, you would find that this person would have a return of being able to walk. And that's happened in a number of documented cases. Now also then, there are the most serious disorders. And again, Freud provided a lot of insight into these things. When people are psychotic, it is not unusual that they have hallucinations. And we used to just think people were crazy. A person's having hallucinations or hearing voices. And in hearing voices that aren't there, we would just say, well, there's just something very crazy about this person. Actually, there are many kinds of hallucinations, and some seem to be pretty bizarre. We haven't really understood much. We do know how to medicate people that will reduce or eliminate a lot of hallucinations. But there are other hallucinations that serve a need. I remember one patient who was walking down the street. He's homeless. He's got no money. Here's a voice telling him, take this brown bag that's just lying right here on the street and go in and tell the bank teller to put some money in it. And then you'll have some money. So this poor homeless man goes in, goes up to the bank teller, and puts this brown bag and says, put some money in this. Well, the bank teller, of course, it gets very frightened, you know, it hits one of those buzzers, the police come racing in, and they arrest the man for bank robbery. And so the man goes to jail, and while he's in jail, I had sent one of our psychiatrists, was in jail by our clinic, so I'd sent one of the psychiatry residents actually to work with this man. And he comes back and tells me that, you know, the guy actually was having these hallucinations, but he didn't really want to rob a bank. That is, there was no motivation to rob a bank. He was really listening to the voices, and the voices were solving a problem for him. He went in. He never told the lady he wanted to rob a bank. He just asked for money, but she panicked. Anyway, this goes to trial. It became quite a well-known trial, in which the prosecution argued that no matter what you say, this is bank robbery, and whether somebody's mentally ill or not is not relevant. This person should go to prison. We don't tolerate bank robbers. The defense was arguing that, first of all, this man didn't intend to rob the bank. This is a very troubled man, and now you can see that he's not psychotic anymore. He's sorry that this happened. He's apologized to the court. He's admitted that he never really wanted to rob the bank. And so we got to the point where they found him guilty of bank robbery. And so they're going to have sentencing. So the psychiatry resident comes to me and says, you know, it would really help, I think, if you would come to court, because we need to convince this judge that this person should not be put in prison. So we go to court. Psychiatry resident testifies and says, you know, tries to make the case, and it's clear the judge is not going to go that way. So he says, you know, I have the director of the clinic with me, and maybe you would want to hear Dr. Sheridan. So they ask me a bunch of questions, and the judge finally says to me, all right. He says, now, Dr. Sheridan, you have testified that this man did not intend to commit this crime, that he's no longer psychotic, but I, the judge, have to be sure that society is safe from him. So I say, well, society is safe from him. I mean, he's been treated by this resident. He'll continue to be treated. He's causing no problem in the jail. You can see yourself. This is a very caring man, etc. The judge said, that's not good enough. What I need you to do is to tell me that you will put him in the hospital. And I said, well, I can't tell you that. He said, well, why can't you? I said, because he doesn't need to be in a hospital. I mean, he's not hallucinating anymore. He knows what he did. He's very willing to cooperate with treatment as an outpatient. And eventually what the judge did was he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give this man the minimum sentence which, by the way, is 5 years in prison. He said, and I said, well, why? He said, because we have never not given a convicted bank robber a prison term, and so we're giving him the least. Now, the reason I tell you the story is it goes to show you in a way that even when we're effective with treatment, and even when somebody out of, you know, in a bizarre situation did something that is interpreted by society as being bad, society has a lot of trouble understanding mental illness. They have a lot of trouble understanding, you know, someone having voices tell them certain things. Now also, you know, psychotic people often suffer from delusions. And again, we tend to blow them off. You know, one better known delusions is when you get somebody who's psychotic and they say, the FBI is following me. The FBI is checking my mail. And, you know, and you realize this is a very psychotic kind of statement. It's very unreal. And there's a tendency to dismiss it rather than to recognize this is meaningful material. That is, this person is benefiting from having this delusion. Often you have someone with this delusion as a person who is homeless, in very hard times. Nobody is paying attention to the person. They may have no job, no income, no friends, or utterly isolated. They feel horrible about themselves. Then all of a sudden, they have this delusion, which makes them terribly important. They are so important, the FBI is following them. The FBI is checking their mail. And of course, that's why they're not getting any mail. That's how they know that the FBI is checking their mail, because they don't get any mail. The reality is, they really aren't getting any mail. They don't have a job, they don't have contact with anyone, they don't have a bank account, they probably don't get any mail. But to admit that I am so insignificant that I don't get any mail is very different than to say, you know, I am so important, the federal government is following me. And so the content, often, of hallucinations and delusions tell us a whole lot about a person, and one doesn't want to just pretend or blow it off as if these are not meaningful. Well, the reason why I want to be sure that you're aware of those things is because psychoanalysis got us thinking about things that we just had not thought about before, and especially to think about meaning in people's lives. And to think about the meaning, and to think about the fact that life is meaningful, that behaviors are meaningful, that thoughts are meaningful, that even slips of the tongue, where seemingly they are mistakes, but they're really not necessarily mistakes. They are unconscious ways of having things be meaningful. And that, you know, really came into our culture and eventually got accepted by an awful lot of people. That is, that life is meaningful, that the things that you do are meaningful, and that the way in which you avoid problems are meaningful, and that if you are avoiding problems in a way that's detrimental to you, there may be a treatment that can help you. And of course, now that we have so many more treatments, including some very effective drugs, you know, we can intervene, whereas in the past, that wouldn't have been what happened. Okay, now, I want to talk with you about one more person who has a stage theory, but it's very different than what we had with Sigmund Freud. We're going to talk about a man named Erik Erikson. Erik Erikson, and you'll see on the slide that's come up, Erik Erikson had an eight-stage theory, and it was a theory of ego development. Now, what's important with Erikson is that he decided that it's much too narrow to think about people the way Freud did, to think that this little baby is born, it's got all these primitive instincts, that it's driven by a pleasure principle, and that the only reason the person actually becomes socially acculturated is because they would be harmed if they expressed these primitive impulses. And so what happens is, Erikson comes along and says, actually, you know, there's two kinds of energy people have. There is an unconscious energy that people have, and often it will seek primitive gratification. But he said, but the ego has its own energy. And the energy in the ego is non-conflictual. That is, the ego will develop throughout life because the ego has its own energy to develop. And it can be creative. It can grow without conflict. It is not trying to repress all kinds of unacceptable impulses. But that life does develop in stages. And so what Erickson said is that what he did is he really expanded psychoanalytic thinking. And he got it. He moved from one that was oriented to psychopathology. Remember now that Freud really developed this theory by seeing patients. And so his goal was to discover why do people have these various problems that we, in those days, were called neuroses, personality disorders, and psychoses. And we have Erickson come along and say, we need to look at everybody. That is, we need to look at the healthy, functioning person. So his stage theory was one in which we would examine how do people grow and how do they grow in a healthy way. And he emphasized the integration of psychosocial forces along with biological forces in the person. And it was the kind of the coming together of these two forces that led to personality development. Now, and what's very important here is he is saying that in the case of many people, you simply grow and develop because you are loved and caring and you're with people. But you do go through a series of stages. I mean, he really bought, Freud's idea that there are developmental stages. You'll see with his eight stages, though, he didn't stop so early. He went right from birth to death. And he recognized that in adulthood, there are many things that go on, that we grow in adulthood and experience things we didn't experience when we were younger. So his is really a health-oriented model. Now, he believed that personality develops in a series of stages that unfolds in a predetermined sequence. He called this the epigenetic principle. So the epigenetic principle is that there are a series of stages that you go through, and as you resolve each stage and move on in this predetermined sequence, your personality unfolds. Now, he decided there were eight stages, and that a person could identify the approximate age where a person experienced each of these developmental stages. And he believed that the ego experienced a specific crisis at each stage that determined the type of coping mechanism that one developed to deal with issues in this stage. You notice if we go back to our eight stages, you'll see that if we have a stage, we have kind of an estimated age of when it occurs. We have a basic crisis that occurs in that stage. And he felt, unlike Freud, that crises were resolved satisfactorily, depending to a considerable degree on the quality of a person's psychosocial relationships. He also believed that the individual was paramount in resolving stages. And he indicated it was the attempts of a person to cope with and be creative during a stage that determined healthy resolution. So the person is not a victim of a lot of impulses. The person is an individual with their own creative energies, and they are going to have to pass through certain stages, and each stage kind of has its own basic crisis to resolve. And if you resolve it, you develop an ego strength. And so you'll see in our slide that each stage, the first stage, you see hope is the ego strength. And in each stage, you develop a certain ability. Now, here it's called ego strength, and that term is used a lot. He also used the term virtue, that if you resolve a stage, the benefit that comes from that resolution is you have acquired a virtue. So for him, kind of ego strength and virtue are synonyms. Now, and importantly, of course, as you go on in these stages, you keep developing these new virtues. Let's see. Now, having posited eight stages, you'll find that Erikson, you know, was influenced, very significantly influenced, really, by Freud, but he broke from him in terms of this theory. I might mention a couple of things, by the way, about Erik Erikson. Erik Erikson was a very famous Harvard professor, and much of his theory was developed while he was actually running the Harvard Clinic. And he is a famous professor of psychology. Erik Erikson has no college degrees. Erik Erikson was a man who grew up in Germany, and he was exposed to a lot of psychoanalytic thinking. You'll see as we talk about him, he was exposed to anthropologists. But he developed all of this theory from a lot of observations he made and from some psychoanalytic training that he underwent. But it's one of those wonderful cases where a man becomes a great theorist. He becomes a very successful university professor, but he didn't go to graduate school. He didn't go to undergraduate school. He had some undergraduate school, but and his early training, by the way, was in architecture. And you're going to see that when we get past the stages Freud talked about, and you'll see, just notice the fifth stage here, which has a lot to do with identity. Erikson learned in his life that he actually was not the son of his father. That is the father he thought he was. His early name was Erik Hamburger, and he was lived in a community of German Jews in Germany. But people began, you know, noticing he didn't look much like a German Jew. In fact, he looked like he probably was Scandinavian. And it turned out he found out that his father really was a Scandinavian. And so he changed his name at one point in his life to Erik Erikson so that he could identify with the Scandinavian heritage. So identity was very important to him. And you'll see that as we go along on these stages. Now, when we get to stage one, which we call the oral sensory stage, which really goes from birth to about age one. Erikson said that the beginning of life is really determined by the quality of social interaction that goes on between a child and the child's mother. And while he said that, you know, later people would say it's really between the child and significant people in the child's life. Some people have a grandmother in the home who may be very significant, a grandfather. Some people are taken care of by a nanny who, in many ways, becomes the mother. Some have older siblings, so that this child was born late and has a brother that's 15 years older, and the brother was a significant caretaker. So it's really the interactions between all of these significant people. But we're going to talk about mother because that's the way Erikson saw it. And he believed that the first thing that has to happen is the child needs to feel safe in the world. And the way the child feels safe is the child relies upon mom. So the presence of the mom was most important. And he posited that the mother has to be an active giving person so the child can experience, you know, really basic security. And in fact, he called that term basic trust. That if the mother is very active and makes sure the child is taken care of, is very warm, very nurturing, the child will develop what he called basic trust. And that meant the child can begin experiencing the external world as a positive force. Now, he also said, if the child doesn't have this experience, the child then begins to develop basic mistrust, which means that as the child is growing, the child is finding that mom or mother figures are not reliable, that this world is not a safe place. In fact, this world is a scary place. So he would posit that the psychopathology that would develop at this time in life develops not because of some primitive urges that this young infant is not taking care of, but rather because the infant is trying to be creative. The infant is trying to solve the issues of being only 6 months old. But what the child unfortunately is learning is that they don't get much of a response. They don't get nurturance. They don't feel safe. And so they develop basic mistrust. Now, like so many theorists, Erikson did believe that an awful lot of learning takes place during the first year of life. And that, again, was a step forward. We, for a long time, we didn't put a lot of focus on that infants are really learning things. But infants learn a lot. And he believed that the healthy child, his definition of healthy, that the child should not be completely trusting, since the real world is not to be completely trusted. And he thought the major outcome of this stage needs to be that the child is far more trusting of the environment than the child is mistrusting. But some mistrust is healthy. If this outcome occurs, the child has a sense of confidence and hope. And it is the virtue of hope that then becomes the ego strength that guides the child through the later stages, the latter part of this stage, and into the next stage. So as the child has repeated experiences with mom and begins to feel safe, begins to feel good about things, then a certain sense of hope comes. That is, the person begins to expect, if things get troubling, I will be taken care of. And Erikson, by the way, thought that the virtue of hope prepared a person for faith, which obviously is necessary if you're going to be a spiritual or religious person. And unlike Freud, Erikson thought religious belief was healthy and that it fostered a sense of real trust and goodness in humankind. So when you talk about psychoanalysis, people often refer to it, especially religious people, as kind of a godless theory. Well, it isn't. It depends on what psychoanalyst are you talking about. But Erikson was very positive about faith and felt that this started very early in a child's life, that once the child had hope, then they had the basis for developing a faith in what might be a supreme being. Now, the next stage then, which took place from about age 2 to 3 or so, was called the muscular anal stage. And this stage actually closely resembles Freud's anal stage. Both posited that toilet training is the major psychological and social experience during the second and third years of life. And interestingly with Erikson, because he'd had a fair amount of exposure to anthropology, he pointed out that this stage is not necessarily universal, nor does it create conflict in all cultures. So, he had this insight and tried to tell people that, we think that, you have to teach the kid, potty training. And, you've got to do it by the time the kid is going to be 2, or people will think the kid is not a good kid, et cetera, et cetera. And he went on to point out, we've made this up. We've determined that that's the age it should happen. But there are lots of cultures where it doesn't happen that early. And also, there are cultures that don't put so much emphasis on this, that people learn, potty training, but it's not the big deal it is in our culture. And he indicates it is a scene for intense conflict in our culture because of our need for cleanliness, punctuality, and our desire for control. He felt those are the reasons for why we insist it's got to take place at age 2. We've named that as the time. We like neatness. We like to have control. So this is the time we teach children this, and we place a great emphasis on it. And it's during this time that children are trained to obey. And one of the things that he pointed out is when you teach children to obey, that will always be a conflictual time. You don't just teach children to obey and they obey. You try to teach them what you want them to do. They always rebel while they're going through this. And so this is a time when the ego begins to strive for independence. And so it's a time when the youngsters have to kind of test what's appropriate. What can I do that I want to do that I can get away with? And what should I not do? Because boy, do people get upset when I do this. So there's a lot of learning going on. And he saw the parent's role as key at this time in helping a child to develop a sense of autonomy so that the child can feel in control and at the same time be able to experiment. So we felt it's okay to potty train the children, and you want to teach the child this. But also, when the child, tries to push the limits, sometimes it's good to let that happen so the child can kind of develop a sense that he or she is in control. Now, the ideal outcome is that the child becomes acculturated, as does what the parents want, but the child ends up feeling a sense of self-control that, I'm kind of doing this because this is what I want to do. And so the ego strength or the virtue that occurs here, Erickson called will. And he said it indicated the experience, which Erickson said indicated, was that will was the experience to appreciate that one had free choice, but at the same time, one had to have some self-constraint. Now, if parents are not good guides during this important developmental phase, children may experience shame and doubt, which leads them to believe that they themselves are really not effective and that they don't have control in their environment. And it is common, then, that what happens with children, if they feel shame and doubt, they become less experimental and they develop rigid personality patterns. If they really fail this stage, or the stage is very rigid, we often associate obsessive-compulsive behavior to this stage. And this is something, of course, an observation that Freud had made, that if the child learns too rigidly, that they have to conform, and they can't give in to any kind of their own creative seekings. And to be loved, they have to do it exactly the way mom and dad wants. Then often the child becomes very rigid, kind of loses their sense of creativity. So you want to realize that developing this virtue of will is terribly important. Now, the next stage is called the locomotor genital stage. As you can see, it takes place between ages 4 and 5. And here, the crisis the youngster is going to have to deal with is called initiative versus guilt. This is, by the way, about the same stage, that Freud had named the phallic stage. But you're going to see that Erickson presents it in a different way. First of all, he presents it as a very interpersonal period where children become curious about their friends and their surroundings. Children begin to be very interested in other children. And for those of you who have children yourselves that are this age, or you have younger brothers and sisters, one of the things you observe is these children ask questions all the time. They incessantly are asking questions. I mean, a healthy kid is a curious kid. And they ask about innumerable things. And we have found that children have very active fantasy lives during this period. 4 to 5 is a time where kids are thinking about all kinds of things. They may not necessarily tell you. Or when they do tell you, often you're kind of surprised. You didn't realize that the child was having those kind of fantasies. And Erickson did believe that children are unduly interested in sex during this period. So as much as the parents don't want to think that, certainly Erickson thought that they really had this, but he saw it as a very healthy interest, and that the child was experiencing considerable stimulation from his or her genitalia, and so it wasn't surprising that they should have a focus on their sexual organs, but that this was quite developmentally appropriate. And he did not get all involved with things like the Oedipus complex or the Electra complex. He rather wanted to focus on the fact that this is a normal developmental stage. Now, he did observe that children at this stage often seem to show an intense interest in the parent of the opposite sex. And he believed this should be encouraged. And he thought that if the child was allowed to indulge in experimenting with being close to the parent of the opposite sex, it would really allow for healthy growth. So very different what he is saying the child needs to go through versus the kind of fantasy life that Freud created for this child. Now, he also said if the neglected parent, so that would be the parent of the same sex as the child, has difficulty with this, it often creates a sense of guilt in the children, especially if the child feels that he or she is being punished for being very close to the opposite sexed parent. So consistent then, you know, with Erikson's theory throughout his stages, he encourages parents to allow the children the freedom to experiment and to learn from whatever initiatives they get into. And it was his belief that if the child resolved this stage, then he or she moved to a higher level of functioning. That is, they became members of a bigger world. And that it was this time in a child's life that the child develops purpose. So the ego strength or the virtue in this phase is called purpose. And so important is this virtue that Erikson believed children actually begin to formulate a sense of life goals as a result of resolving this stage. That is, if children are really allowed to get involved with other kids and they're allowed to relate to their opposite sex parent and they're allowed to feel warm and safe and they don't run into a lot of conflict, they begin to pick up there's a bigger world out there. I wonder what I'm going to do in the world. Now, you also want to note that Erikson certainly, was a product of his own times. And as a result, he tended to stereotype activities that, you know, some activities were male, some activities were females, some activities males engaged in, some activities females engaged in. And he stereotyped females as often being more passive and less engaged in activities that might lead, say, to power and to creativity later in life. And actually, he's been criticized by feminists. And he responded that he did not intend, in his theory, to set limits on women. That wasn't what he wanted to do, but he kind of got trapped into making some comments like that because that was kind of the stereotype of the time. And other psychoanalysts who followed him, especially female psychoanalysts, have really pointed out how you could make some shifts in his theory and you really wouldn't have this problem. So he wasn't disliked by women analysts the way, in some cases, Freud was, because people saw that he really was trying to develop a theory that was a good theory for both men and women. However, you know, when you go back to these days, I mean, in society itself, there was tremendous prejudice against women having the same freedoms as men. And I'm sure you've, you know, studied this in many of your classes, but if you just look at the data, I talked to a physician the other day who was telling me in his medical school class, there were 4 women. You know, today more than half the class in medical school is female. 55% of the classes or so in law school are female. Sandra Day O'Connor, I think, who's chief or is one of the justices of the Supreme Court, I think she was either the only woman in her law school or she was one of 2. And here is a woman, you know, so talented. I mean, she graduates from Stanford Law School. Anybody know what her first job was? This is back down in 1950, so it's long before, I mean, it's after Erikson is writing this. Sandra Day O'Connor's first job after getting a law degree from Stanford was to become a paralegal. She got a secretarial position. You know, and, you know, here is someone with this very prestigious degree, but people weren't ready for this. So when you're reading these theories sometimes and you see, and if you read Erikson and you see kind of strange references, you want to realize the time in which this person was writing. And Erickson later in his life did recognize that. He tried very hard to overcome that and to say, you know, that it wasn't his intention to do this, but it's just the way it was at those times. Okay, now we then move on to what is called the latency stage. And this loosely follows Freud's latency period. It occurs between the ages of 6 and 12. However, this is very different than Freud. And during this time, Erickson's focus for children was their learning of new skills. And he felt that children develop a sense of industry, whereby they move into a larger world that they feel they have control. And he noted that teachers are particularly important people during this time, and that the loving and caring teacher who rewards a child does a great deal to develop this virtue of industry. He also said that if the child fails to develop this virtue of industry, they will develop feelings of inferiority. And this may lead to regression, where a child seeks parental protection rather than moving towards autonomy. So it's a terribly important time. Child's either going to move out there towards autonomy and creativity, or they're going to get very scared and want to go back and have mom and dad be protective. Now, the virtue that he felt was developed during this stage, he called competence, meaning the child has begun to experiment with new behaviors. And the child believes that he or she can excel and take risks without experiencing anxiety. And that's the key in this, is that the child is able to try out a lot of things. Now, you can see, if you reflect back in your own life when you were in school, if you reflect back on teachers, I mean, sometimes you remember teachers with a great fondness, that this teacher was good to you, that this teacher encouraged something in you that brought something out of you, that, you know, you developed what we might call a virtue, that you developed the strength because of this teacher. You also may recall teachers, you know, who were mean-spirited, who frightened you. You wouldn't dare take a risk in this person's class. And as a result, you know, you went through a year of your life going to school, always being very cautious. Now, luckily, you know, because the world of school is larger than the classroom, you may have tried out a lot of things, you know, in the cafeteria, on the playground, in other places, but not in that person's classroom. And Erickson, you know, really made what I thought was a very key observation, that those are not just events that are minor in someone's life, that they're major, that teachers play a tremendous role. And whether people begin to feel autonomous, they begin to feel excited, and they find their way, you know, to a new world. Are you finding yourselves comfortable in following the distinctions between Freud and Erickson as we go through these stages? Okay, because the changes are significant. And we're going to continue in our next session, finishing up these stages, and you'll see we are now about to move from the stages we've been talking about, which are pretty much early childhood experiences, into what happens with the rest of life. And it's nice to know there is something in life beyond when one is 5 or 6 years old. So, but we'll deal with that in our next class.